Welcome to Family Anatomy. It's time for your weekly dose of information and insight into kids, families, and couples with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano,
Dr. Richard Bulduk,
and Dr. Brian McDonald. We're psychologists, but we're not your psychologist. So if you need to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. Let's get right into it. The big episode 4 of Family Anatomy. Today we're going to talk about childhood fears.
Yes, and this is going to be episode 1 of a 2-part extravaganza.
It's good that you decided that ahead of time.
Extravaganza. That's fantastic.
Isn't it?
Yes, it's a good way to put it. It's
welcome theater. To NPR, ladies and gentlemen.
It's theater of the mind here, fellas.
By the way, last episode, the fictional names for my kids were William and, or Jean-Luc and William, I believe.
Yes.
I've decided to change those.
Yeah,
I've decided to call them the eldest Robert and the youngest Philip.
Robert and Philip.
Well, like they have nothing to do with Star Trek now.
No,
is that
no,
you're
no,
going
totally
off the Star Trek
that.
Theme?
I didn't like that.
No.
And you guys only gave me about 3 seconds to figure that one out. So
he's been. You should see the whiteboard here in the studio. He's got names written down and crossed off. There's about 2 dozen names down there,
yeah,
and so
no.
You chose. What were those names again? Sorry,
the first ones or the second set?
The new ones.
The new ones are Philip and Robert.
Yeah, it's not right. We gave him 3 seconds. He needed 3 days.
Yeah,
exactly.
So after all that editing, we're okay with those names now.
Fair enough.
So let's move on.
So why did you want to do an episode about childhood fears? This was a Dr. G's choice. He thought childhood fears would be a good one.
Well, yeah, it's something I think that most parents are going to come across. Your kids are young, vulnerable, looking for you to provide a sense of safety and security. And, you know, this is something that, like I say, all parents are going to have to deal with at some time. And certainly I've had to deal with it. And we've talked about it amongst ourselves. I thought it'd be a good topic for the people to get a sense of what we've been through. And also, again, as a psychologist, of what we've done about it.
Well, sorry, Richard. One of the things that came up, I think for us in our lunchtime discussions in between talking about big screen TVs and speakers was that our kids seemed to go through a phase where they became afraid of certain things and it seemed to be around the same ages.
Right. Exactly. So,
well, I was going to make the link and I think you touched on it, the difference between say fears and anxiety for that matter.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference between fear and anxiety, Dr. B?
Well, I don't know, but I certainly could certainly give a bit of insight on it. I would think that an anxiety would be deeper rooting as opposed to a fear being more of a behavioral response, would it not?
Right. So, I mean, if we're talking about an anxiety disorder, for instance, yes, there's a big difference between that and having normal fears. There's normal fears. When we're talking about babies, say between 6 months and 2 years of age, you're talking about separation anxiety. This is a normal thing that happens. If parents aren't aware of it, they can be concerned about this, but this is absolutely normal. If the parent leaves the room but between those ages I just mentioned, then you're going to have maybe some crying and some fear going on with your child. That's completely normal.
I remember way back when we were taking our psychology courses, they used to talk about 6 months as being that's the time when babies are starting to really remember that things exist when they're not right there in front of them in the room.
That's right.
That's the time when those relationships are really first starting, is around 6 months of age when they start to, what did they call it? Object permanence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, basically, going back to our own personal experiences, anything that you guys noticed with your kids?
I didn't actually notice much of that with either of my kids. I didn't, but of course it did happen. It wasn't any, and it, maybe it's because I'm aware of it and I'm not sort of taken aback by it. It hasn't sort of stuck in my mind very much, that particular thing. The other sort of developmental stage that fear happens in, that's quite normal, again, between about 6 months and 2 years of age, is a kind of stranger anxiety. And I remember friends coming to visit, and this one friend would say to me, "Is he making strange yet? Is he making strange yet?"
That one before.
Yeah. Moms always say that. I know. That's something my mom would ask us.
And that doesn't necessarily have to happen with strangers. It could even be family members, an uncle that comes once in a while, or even grandparents that come for a visit, mm-hmm. and they haven't seen them for a while. They just don't. They're not comfortable with the whole situation.
Well, I know for me, talking about childhood fears was a big one because my guys didn't have anything really major. In terms of things, things would come up that would scare them. For example, if they go in the swimming pool and they get splashed in the swimming pool for the first time, those kinds of things, they get a little bit nervous. But I know though that I was, I guess, conscious of the idea that they were going to need some strategies to deal with, because both myself and their mom have sort of a family history where some of our family members are pretty anxious to the point where they needed to really use some strategies to help them get through it.
That's right. And we're going to get into that different strategies that we can use when it's not normal fears in particular, but even when it's normal fears. I mean, the obvious things are to, validation is always the number one thing whenever you're talking about emotional distress of any kind. But some fears come out of different developmental stages. So you'll get the three-year-old that might be still a little bit concerned about the parents being away. A five-year-old might start being afraid of monsters because they have that imaginative capability starting to happen. A teenager, of course, there's a lot of changes with teenagers, and anytime there's a change, there's a potential for anxiety. So, but not anxiety disorders, okay, mm-hmm. but just fears.
I would think
fears.
There would be also a social component to that, would there not?
Sure.
With adolescence?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know at some point, a lot of kids, now I haven't gone back into my Psych 101 textbook or anything like that to get the specifics, but I know that a lot of kids, they just develop briefly a fear of losing their eyesight.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's often a big one. For a little while anyway. I think it's pretty natural.
Giuseppe, was there a bit of research on this done in the years?
About eyesight?
Yeah. No, well, not eyesight, but we were talking about anxiety and fears.
We have a couple of quirky kind of research articles that we've looked at.
The one thing that Giuseppe always does is if there's ever an article about someone's brain getting chopped up, he prints it out.
I do.
Interesting.
Yeah,
what would you like to
and
talk
the
about
finer
that?
The little cuts, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I find. Mm-hmm.
Did you used to work in a rat lab at some point?
I didn't. I know people that did.
Of my best friends are rat researchers.
Don't we have a colleague actually that
we do? We yes. do. I worked in a chimp lab.
Really?
I did.
As a subject?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's talk about. We have a list of a couple of things, but I know, like I was saying earlier, I was concerned about my kids being nervous about things and their reactions to fears because there's a family history. And certainly one thing that we know about anxiety is that the kind of base level of anxiety that you wake up with in the morning, the second you get out of bed, how stressed you are, your reaction to stress is to some extent inherited. So some people have a bigger tolerance for things that happen during their day that might stress them out or that they might become anxious about.
Even coping for that matter? How to better cope with that stress or anxiety?
Well, I think that some people have have a greater need to use coping strategies because they just tend, their bodies, they physically react more to stressful things that happen to them in their day-to-day life.
Exactly. So maybe we should talk a little bit about the physiological aspect of this thing.
Right.
What happens is anxiety can be a very helpful protective thing. And that's the way evolutionarily it has developed.
They call that optimal, right? At an optimal level where you're able to just use that anxiety and it actually contributes to wellness.
Well, even right. Now they know that about tests and exams, right? There's right. A certain optimal level of anxiety. You don't want to be too relaxed and
blow it off as too easygoing. And
exactly.
Then,
yeah. But if you're too stressed out, it's hard to concentrate.
Exactly.
That's right. You can't focus. So you want that sort of peak level where your performance doesn't start to drop off, but you have enough energy that anxiety gives you that you're able to really carry it off. What I was thinking about there, if we can just step back a second, is anxiety developed. Just to give a little context for this, anxiety is a very protective thing, as I was saying before. Thousands of years ago, this was the way that our bodies reacted to threat, and the threats were quite real. Could be, you could have a very ferocious animal after you, and your body needed to figure out a way to protect you from that. And what they call that is a fight or flight response. And so what happens there is there's a chemical that's released into your bloodstream, adrenaline and noradrenaline, a couple of chemicals that are released, and they activate parts of your body. So you breathe heavier, your heart starts racing, your palms start sweating, your pupils dilate, your stomach starts to be active. There's a lot of different physical things that start to happen to you. All of those things are meant to be protective. So when your pupils dilate, you take in more information. This is what they say. When you're starting to be sweaty, that makes it harder for you to be captured.
Can you just clarify for our listeners, when you're talking about flight or fight, is that just like basically you want to take off or you're going to fight? Is that really the situation? I know that I don't want to sound too vague
That's exactly. So when you're stuck, so part of what happens is your blood gets redirected to your extremities. So, and then this is one of the reasons you start to feel dizzy as well. Some of the blood comes from your brain, like not enough to be dangerous, but gets redirected towards your arms and your legs, allowing you to either fight or to run. And this gets you away from that danger, that very physical type of danger that was more common in the past. In today's society, we have very sort of existential type of dangers as well. It's not always a physical type of danger. Makes it a little bit more difficult to deal with.
But when you're talking about flight or fight, and I know we want to relate it back to kids, but it certainly it makes me think of something that's genetically coded or something that's not necessarily environmental. You know, that fear or that threat might be environmental, but how we deal with that is very much on a, you know, on a genetic level.
That's right. It's an ancient system for the human body to protect itself from threat. So that's what we're talking about. It can be alarming to have some of these feelings or to see these feelings in your kids. But the thing you want to remember is that as long as that anxiety isn't debilitating, that is, isn't really negatively affecting like their school, their schoolwork, their friendships, and so on, in a serious way, then some anxiety is actually a good thing.
And that's the key when you're looking at the difference between regular stress or worry or fears and an anxiety disorder, is that the disorder is something that's more persistent and it has an impact on some area of your life, usually in more than one area, whether it's school or social relationships or family relationships or your performance in some other area.
And maybe just for clarification, an anxiety or some anxiety disorder can also bring about, and we're talking about kids in schools, well, there could also be a school phobia that could emerge from that, right? So phobias are also connected to that anxiety, I should say.
Exactly. So that's when you start to see that there's something a little more serious than just having an everyday fear, and it's something that really gets debilitating. There are kids who are so anxious they cannot go to school. They just are not able to get to school. And that's something that develops partly as a result of how the adults around that child deal with that initial fear that they that they show.
So tracking that behavior, as we talked about earlier, is important to understand what that anxiety might be.
For sure, yeah. And I think one of the things that we know about anxiety is that a strategy that's commonly used is to avoid the thing that makes you anxious. If you're afraid of dogs, you know, you might cross the street if there's a big dog, you know, being walked on that side of the street.
Or get introduced and become friendly with it. Yeah. And understand that it doesn't become a threat any longer.
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be a positive strategy for sure. But I think for many people, if you're scared of something, you try to avoid it. And the thing about avoiding it is that it works. You feel less stress. You know, nothing bad happened related to the thing that you were afraid of. Whatever it was you were scared of doesn't bother you or harm you in any way. And so that whatever it is that you're afraid of becomes a bigger deal the next time. You're more likely to avoid it because that avoidance strategy works so well.
Well, I'm happy we're talking about dogs because of course, talking about our children, my eldest boy does have that fear of dogs and is not comfortable when there's a dog barking, just absolutely is aware of that. So that's something we're dealing with right now.
Well, my son is totally the opposite. In fact, today, we were walking down one of the main streets down here in town, and it's a nice spring day, you know, one of the nicer spring days so far here, and there were dogs all up and down that sidewalk, and he stopped every single owner and asked if he could pet the dog.
Sometimes you wish they would be a bit more afraid of dogs.
No, but I've taught him to do that. So he'll go to the owner, and before he goes anywhere near the dog, he'll say, "Can I touch your dog, please?" I'm kind of screening the owners at the same time there.
But he's being good because he knows to go to the owner or the master or whatever you might want to call
exactly,
the person.
Exactly.
We'll ask to permission, which is
that's right,
probably
to make
the right
sure
way to go about
that it's a safe thing to do. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't have that particular fear at all. Here's the thing to keep in mind, too. Like, your son has a fear of dogs. It's not a debilitating thing, right? It could be if you wanted to be a veterinarian someday, that would be a real problem. So you have to sort of take these things in context. If you live in Alaska and you have a fear of sandy beaches, well, I think you're going to be all right.
You're going to be okay. You're going to make it.
It's going to have an impact on your life for sure.
Yeah,
but there might be sand in Alaska, though.
Is there sand in Alaska?
Very likely along the shores there, yes.
Really?
Yes.
There's in some jars, I guess.
Yeah.
On Family Anatomy, you learn about geography and everything.
There you go.
Yeah. So, but when it is a debilitating thing, that's when you really want to be concerned because it's something that's part, like I say, if they're not able to go to school. If when they get to school, they're so fearful, they don't talk. And that's something that we call selective mutism.
Right. So basically, when there's interference and there's basically it is affecting your normal functioning, it becomes a concern.
Sure, yeah. If you're avoiding school, I mean, you're obviously going to fall behind in your schoolwork and you're not going to progress at the same rate as your classmates are, and that's going to have a big impact on your performance academically.
Well, then we're talking academic, but we're also talking with regard to social development, and we could even link it to moving on beyond the high school years and into adulthood.
So what do you do then when that fear is starting to become more of a problem, whether it's something that's reaching the point that you might wonder if there's a disorder, an anxiety disorder, or whether it's just something that's just starting to get in your child's way in terms of dealing with things that happen in their everyday life?
Well, I mean, the important thing to remember is, because I think the natural thing, the intuitive thing that a parent does is that you're afraid of that, let's just get away from it. It seems like a very easy, intuitive, perfectly sound thing to do, and it does work. You walk away from it, your anxiety level goes down, that means your heart stops racing, your palms stop sweating, your breathing goes back to normal, you're nice and relaxed now. It works. Why not just keep doing it?
Well, nobody wants their kids to feel that way. You know, you see your child who's upset and scared, and maybe they're crying about a dog that they've heard barking, or about something that happened. I mentioned the swimming pool before, but something that happened in the pool. You want to stop that. You want to comfort them and make them feel better as fast as possible. And the fastest, easiest, the first, I think anyway, the first reaction for a parent is let's get them away from that situation and distract them with something else.
But what about a situation, and this is something that happens so much in schools, for instance, a bully, where you don't have that control necessarily about that environment, and you know there's a concern there, and you know that you have to do something, but you don't have, you can't necessarily interfere in that social context.
Well, and actually bullying is one of the things that we're going to devote an entire half hour to at some point, but I think with all of these situations, if there's a fear that's becoming a persistent one, that you try and help your child learn some strategies for what do you do to deal with them, whether it's a bully or whether it's a dog.
So communication is very important.
But the number one thing to keep in mind, because we've been talking about avoiding what's making you fearful. First of all, the first thing you need to do is make sure it's the situation. Because let me just say, the number one thing, let's not keep the audience in suspense. Number one thing is exposure. They need that experience. Whatever they're fearful of, they need that experience. That's the number one thing to keep in mind. Now, having said that, you need to make sure that exposure is safe. So if your child wants to go skydiving without a parachute, it's probably not a good exposure.
You're not going to put somebody with a fear of, that the garbage can is going to catch on fire. You're not going to start throwing matches in the garbage can until it catches on fire to show them.
We all know the experience of people that are afraid of flying, for instance, and they go in the plane, and eventually they do have to face that fear, correct?
Exactly. Actually, that's my wife. She's afraid of flying, and we both know what she needed to do, and that was get on a plane, exposure, and she did it several times this past year, and guess what?
But you didn't just say, okay, let's go. You pick her up kicking and screaming and drag her onto an airplane.
That would be called flooding.
Or right. Then you'd want to think about progressive desensitization.
Oh, listen to this.
We're getting warmed up now.
You're $5 words.
Jeez. This is what happens when you get three psychologists in a room. Now everybody knows.
Yeah, our meetings at work are long.
Yeah. Well, let's put it in layman's terms. If the exposure, the experience you're trying to get them to have that they're afraid of, that is perfectly safe, is too overwhelming, it's going to blow them back.
I mean, the trick is that you want to expose them to it, but in a way that's going to be positive. If they're scared that something bad is going to happen when they go to school, or when they go for a swim in the pool, or when they walk in the park and there's a dog there, and you put them into that situation and something bad happens, guess what? Their fear isn't going to be less.
That's right.
It's going to be worse next time.
So you want it to be gradual.
Absolutely.
And I mean, if a therapist had, let's say that your son wanted to be, a veterinarian. And this was a big deal now. He's afraid of dogs. He loves all kinds of other animals, but vets deal with a lot of dogs. If that were the case and he was seeing a professional, maybe the first time he goes to see that professional in the office, professional has a psychologist has a picture of a dog, right? Then maybe the second time the child goes in, the psychologist has a movie of a dog.
Is that what you do?
Oh, yeah.
In your office?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah. The third time the child would come in, then you would have a stuffed dog.
You know, you're leaving out a step, though. I think one of the most important things when you're trying to help someone to face
a strategy.
A fear like that is to have some trick to help them relax.
Right.
Because that dog is going to stress them out. And for some people, even the beginning of the physical reaction of fear, you talked about the sweaty palms and the heart racing and things like that, you become afraid of that feeling too.
That's right. Now, you need those strategies. You're exactly right. You need those strategies to keep you in that exposure situation.
So that you can make it to the end and realize nothing bad is going to happen. If I see a picture of a dog, that's not so bad.
I think as adults, and we're talking as parents, and we're also focusing on this from a perspective that you have some power over thought stopping, or you can kind of like push this aside or say this is not happening. But for kids, that's not so easy.
No. Now, I have a Sam and Max story that also, I guess, illustrates maybe a generational gap. And I'll say it real quick because I'm conscious of time. But I remember there was one time we were at a restaurant that had the little playground inside. And the two boys were off and they were playing on their own and they were having a great time. And we were just sort of on the other side of the glass watching them do their thing. And the younger guy, Max, banged his nose on the way down one of those slides and he had a bleeding nose and he was having a fit. He was in a panic and his nose was bleeding. And so we took him out and we got him all cleaned up. And, you know, the first thing, my mom was there, their grandmother was there with us. And she was ready to pack. Okay, let's pack him up. We'll go somewhere else. My older son, Sam, said, oh, no, Oma, we can't do that. He has to go back up the slide so that he doesn't start to get scared of going down the slide. So it was his older brother who said, okay, buddy.
He knew that intuitively or he knew it because he had heard you?
We had done the same kind of thing before around the example I gave of the swimming pool before was one that, like I said, you can really tell that he's the child of a psychologist. He's because he remembers everything, and he spits it back out at you. But it was the older brother who kind of helped calm the younger guy down and said, "Okay, just take a deep breath and let's do it. You love the slide. Let's go give it another go." And he did, and was
that
fine.
Worked, eh? Yeah.
So let's cover this a little bit before we sign off here. You want to definitely experience the fear that you're having. If you're a parent of a child, you got to think that the child needs to go through that experience to get over it. They say, feel the fear and do it anyway. And that's what that is. You need some strategies. Some of those strategies might be deep breathing. They might be some self-talk that you say things to yourself. They might be distraction type strategies as well.
When kids are all tensed up, they can be that wet noodle, for instance.
Yeah. I think the fastest breathing exercise that I ever gave to a young child, and they got it right away, it was very quick, was take a deep breath through your nose and try to make the air touch the back of your eyeballs.
That'll work. Wait a second.
Try that at home.
That's pretty intense there.
Try that at home because it's a distraction. They really think about it. They take a deep breath. And all of a sudden, their mind is on something else.
That's it.
I get lots of feedback that works really well.
So, three things to remember?
One other thing before we get to that. It's all right to retreat from a situation. It's not good for fears to avoid that situation. So let's say that fear starts to get a little too high. The child can pull back from that experience and then re-enter it. That's what you want to do. You want to retreat, but not escape.
Mm-hmm. Right. To make sure that the experience isn't so negative that the fear becomes greater.
Exactly.
Right.
So maybe through the three things to remember, that first one I could say is through what you said, Giuseppe, and what Brian was alluding to is that you want to avoid avoidance.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't, because avoidance is what makes those fears become bigger in the long run.
Right, that's one thing. Another thing that we want to emphasize is that there's a lot of normal fears that kids go through, particularly when there's changes in their life and different stages that they go through. Anytime there's a change, there's a potential for some normal fears to come about from that. And that's okay. It's when you get into a situation and we have a evolutionary kind of system, physical system to help us deal with that. And that's all okay. It's when things start to get more pervasive and start to affect very important parts of your life that you're starting to think about a professional.
That's right. And that's the third thing is that anxiety disorders are different from normal fears because it's only a disorder when it has a big impact on your everyday functioning in some area. So that's it. That's the end. And we're out of here. So check the website at familyanatomy.com. My email address is brian@familyanatomy.com.
Mine is richard@familyanatomy.com.
And mine is g@familyanatomy.com. And I wanted to say just one last thing because I didn't say this in the last episode, but I think it's important to say. I think the people need to get to know us a little bit better. And I just wanted to say, I think something, a little bit of a revelation for the people out there is important for every episode.
Are you suggesting you're going to reveal something now?
I am going to reveal a little something.
Right, let's hear it.
Well, Dr. Brian and Dr. Richard are in love.
In love?
That's news to us.
With fine wine and light rock.
Wow. Wow. Every episode, you need to talk about fine wine and light rock.
What about audiophile stuff, eh?
We that too, yeah.
A little bit of that.
So if you like the show, vote for us at Podcast Alley or leave us a comment on iTunes. And we're ready to sign out once again with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, who's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening. Get up and sing. It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com